that tweet that I put out that you referenced, where I was like, hey, where can I get like a military UAV? People commented, and I ended up having a conversation, like an IRL conversation over coffee with one guy who said, you know, like anything is basically attainable because I have this military background. Anything's attainable in the US. But let me put you in contact with one of my friends. He's a war dog in Turkey and Bolivia. Like, he's an arms dealer. And he could probably get you either a cannon or a drone a lot cheaper and with a lot less red tape than in America. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So that was pretty cool.
Now is the time to take risk.
Cool. So today's podcast is with Augustus DiRico. He's basically water abundance personified. He's super obsessed with terraforming, cloud seeding, groundwater, deadlifts, agency, Twitter, you know, all these kind of things. And so that's what this podcast is about. And if you're here from his groundwater Twitter thread in Ohio, we recorded this beforehand. So I do wish we had discussed that aspect a little bit more. But either way, thanks for being here. And this should be fun. It's the first podcast back in a while. So if you're still here from previous podcasts, that's awesome. And if this is your first time, I hope you enjoy it. So let's get into it.
Dude, I love that you have the standing position too. Just the absolute Chad just going to stand for.
Yeah, no, it's the mogging over video call.
Dude, that's a huge mog. Yeah, man. So your Twitter bio says water abundance, like in just all caps. How did you get into this?
Yeah, dude, super serendipitously. I did not think that I would work in water for my time in college. I thought I would be some like SaaS bro, maybe a crypto bro. And then while I was living in Texas over the pandemic, I was just working out at this gym. Turns out, like, many billionaires happen to lift at this gym. Many other super affluent folks lifted at this gym. And yeah, right. And I was just personal training there for yucks because I like to lift. And I'm shooting the breeze with this one guy and he says, hey, I've got all these, you know, well production permits to file. It's such a pain in my rear end. And I said, well, why don't you tell me about that? Like, what's a well production permit? And it turns out that there's all these new regulations across the American Southwest that dictate how much you're allowed to pump out of your well for a farm, for a factory, for a corporate campus. And all of this is done in the status quo manually, right? So there's some analog meter off in the middle of a field somewhere they have to trudge out to read, to write into a report, and then fax into the regulator to tell them how much you pumped, which is just like archaic, you know? Yeah. Like one of these many super old, forgotten industries in middle America, groundwater. So Jason and I, that's his name, we start talking about this. I found out he's the biggest groundwater driller in Texas. And then I say, well, why don't you just automate this? And he says, what do you mean automate? And so my data science—
That's how you know you struck gold.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So my data science background from Berkeley and his expertise in water well drilling came together. And then we started TerraSeco, which is the company that we're working on now that automates regulatory compliance for groundwater users. And since starting that, I've just been engrossed in all things water, trying to solve every step of the problem, from how we get water, how we use water, how we allocate water and like report its usage. So I think about this all the time these days.
And so the next step beyond groundwater compliance is kind of getting into like cloud seeding, terraforming, that kind of thing.
Exactly, dude. So the rationale there, or like the way that I sort of walked into water abundance, was by working in groundwater regulatory compliance. And so what I mean is, like, it makes sense to be a good steward of our natural resources, right? Like, we should use things efficiently. We should not be wasteful. But if we focus too much on economizing and regulating and restricting our use of water without simultaneously producing more, we get this dystopian scenario where you have to use a low flow toilet and like you can only take 5 minute showers and all of this other ridiculous stuff. Like, you know, and we can
talk early 2000s mindset.
Dude, exactly. Right. Like, just very anti-Malthusian. Right. And we should be over this by now, but we aren't. So I want to talk about like how we can make more water via cloud seeding, what we can use all of the new water we can produce for, like terraforming the Salton Sea, like your video talks about, and like restoring the Colorado River, turning all this wasteland desert into arable farmland. Like, it's crazy. And we can talk, sorry, not to get ahead of myself, but like China is terraforming 2 million acres of the Gobi Desert right now. Right?
Please get ahead of yourself and let's get into the details. How are they terraforming the Gobi Desert?
Yeah, totally. So the Gobi Desert, you know, is, or it has been for a long time, encroaching on fields and cities in northern China. There's been huge dust storms that are a huge pain for people to deal with. They're causing respiratory issues for people, also kind of like the Salton Sea is now. And way long ago, like in the 60s, the Chinese realized, like, what if we just plant trees here instead? Like, what if we just literally super low tech? What if we just plant trees across millions of acres to prevent dust storms from getting kicked up?
They must have seen Mr. Beast Team Trees.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Beast stole it from them. And so that's what they've been doing for years and years. And like they're re-greening, or they're greening lots of stuff that hasn't been green for millennia. And there's a caveat to what they're doing, which is the water angle, right? So although in some places it's been super successful, they have established forests. They have, you know, fauna coming to these forests that otherwise never would have gone. There are some areas where the now super deep tap roots of the trees that they've planted are taking all of the available groundwater from what little native flora there already was. And that's drying out the soil even more, which is expediting the aridification of some areas. So that's bad. And I think that that is sort of like a cautionary tale for any terraforming endeavor that we take up or that anybody takes up, right? Like you need to think about the ecological angle, the water angle, the everything in between, you know, like minerals and
yeah, I mean, this is one of the common critiques of cloud seeding is that it'll take water from other areas. And so it's more like, yeah, we have an abundance of water in the ocean for like, I'm assuming is where everyone's assuming we're going to have this abundant water come from. And we just need to transport it to new locations. And so how is, do you know how China's solving that aridation?
They're getting to the biggest cloud seeding project of all time. They've announced that they're going to cloud seed, and I just wrote about this on my Substack, 2 million square miles of the country. So they're going to cause 5 to 10% more precipitation all across their country, like at a scale that is almost the size of like the United States west of the Mississippi.
Wow.
Yeah, so they announced that in 2020. The pandemic slowed it down, but they're ramping that back up and like they're crushing it.
So are they planning to bring that water to the Gobi Desert or to the other side of the Green Wall? There's more forests.
All over the country. So they're going to enhance what areas already are green and then create greenery like in the Gobi Desert by seeding there too.
Okay. Do you know if they're, what kind of cloud seeding technology they're going to use?
Yeah, dude. So this is part of what's crazy about like cloud seeding technology as it is. We don't talk about it. We barely do it. Like the UAE, this little country in the middle of like Arabia, does it more than we do. Mm-hmm. But it's the same tech that we've had since the 60s, essentially, right? You strap on some salts, some particular salts that cause supercooled water and clouds to crystallize, become sufficiently heavy to fall, and then turn into rain. You strap on flares that release these salts to a like Cessna plane, basically, and you fly these planes into clouds. And that's essentially all you need to do. You can do it with rockets. The UAE has started doing it with drones, so making it a more precise system with less humans in the loop. But China is just using something that has been around since the 60s and underutilized.
Wait, so how do you do it with rockets? Like, are we doing this from space or? From the upper atmosphere, or what's this?
So you can think about it like an artillery barrage, basically, on the ground, right? So think about the sort of, you know, like rocket barrages you see in World War II movies or some other film, blasting said rockets from the ground into the clouds and not containing an explosive charge to destroy stuff, but containing the salts that you disperse into the cloud to cause precipitation.
Yeah, I remember when the Dubai study came out, or when they were actually experiencing massive amounts of rain in Dubai, and the researchers there, it's kind of conflicting information. Like one source said that they were just using like pure electrical charges to make the water molecules coalesce into bigger water droplets. And then another source was saying that there were some nanoparticles being used. And then I know the common method is silver iodide.
Yeah. So the data that comes out of the UAE is limited, but exists. They do claim to be doing it with electric charges right now, but that's much more unproven. I would love to see more research come out around that, and just more research come out around the applications, even of the old methods. Have you heard of a Project Storm Fury by chance?
Yes. Yeah, that was in like the 70s, right?
Yes, exactly.
Give us the history.
Sure. So in the 40s, Americans realized we can cause precipitation in clouds, right? We also realized that in causing this precipitation, we release latent heat from the cloud, right? What that does to, say, a tropical storm or a hurricane, what releasing the latent heat from that storm does is it causes it to expand and then consequently slow the wind speeds of that weather event, right? Slow the wind speeds of that tropical storm. So what we would do, the Weather Modification Bureau, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, was we would fly planes into the Atlantic to basically like attack and destroy hurricanes before they reached the coast, which is awesome. Yes. And we used to do this in Guam too. We would try to mitigate the effect of typhoons that hit Japan. And eventually we just dialed it back because there was one instance of a hurricane that after being seeded, changed course and like hit the United States, like hit somewhere in Georgia. It generally seems like that would have happened anyway, regardless of whether the cloud was seeded. Most of the time what happened was the wind speeds would reduce like 30%. So I'm from New England, right? And I remember, you know, Hurricane Sandy, Irene, people in Louisiana and like the Southwest remember tons of hurricanes themselves and like this disruptive force. Imagine if the damage done by them was reduced only 30%. And just because the wind speeds are reduced 30%, that doesn't mean that that's like the cap of the damage reduction possible by seeding hurricanes, right? Like you could reduce the damage by hurricanes 100-fold if we were to pursue this again. But, you know, it just gradually sort of petered out. People started focusing on other things. People stopped believing it was possible or stopped caring to really like,
or they got scared to change the weather because, you know, playing God is the critique.
Well, yeah. And, you know, like playing God is bad. Like pretending that we have total dominion over the universe is bad. But I think that like the early Abrahamic religions, Christianity points out something really important about human nature. And it's that there's this divine creative cultivating spark within us, right? Like it is in human's nature. It is within human nature to impose its will on the world and on nature in a way that can cultivate and better it, right? To make it a garden, like before the fall in the story of Genesis, right? Like before we left the garden, we worked in the garden and we cultivated the garden. So I think it's a very important thing for us to do to maximally enhance the world around us. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe it's scary. Maybe sometimes we do things wrong. I think though, if we're shrewd and considerate and plan for as many eventualities as possible, we can take like a stewardly role in cloud seeding, in stopping hurricanes, in impacting the world and terraforming.
Totally. And that's why I created Terrapunk, because I think solarpunk is very much so about like reducing our impact, conserving Earth, which is great. I'm not against that, but it doesn't go far enough in terms of like, oh, well, we should actually like terraform and make it better than we found it or than it is right now. We shouldn't just return to baseline. We should go above baseline and make it even better. And so that's why I'm super excited just to see you like on Twitter, just talking about cloud seeding. Like, where do you think you would start with this?
Yeah. So I think Delian from Varda talks about this problem that science projects face a lot, right? Which is where they do something that is scientifically very cool, that provides a lot of data, that's interesting, but is not commercially scalable, right? Like manufacturing stuff on the International Space Station is a really bad way to manufacture stuff in space, even though it would be cool to manufacture stuff in space. So like in the past, we've done research projects around cloud seeding, right? What I think the viable path to commercialization for cloud seeding is, and the way to make it super prevalent and super common, is to start either with like ski resorts and give them snowpack earlier in the season so that they could open the trails and people could shred gnar in like November instead of, you know, December or January. Or alternatively, you know, small farms that are interested in reducing their demand, their groundwater demand, could like pay for cloud seeding as well. So I think that those are like the, you know, MVP candidates for cloud seeding. But then really what you want to upscale to is like the top of every watershed in an arid region, right? So, you know, like the 8,000 square miles that cover the Salton Sea are all ripe to be cloud seeded in, right? So I think that you start small. I think that you prove out that it's possible on things like ski resorts and farms, and then maybe you shift to using like government contracts to change entire swaths of land and geography.
That makes sense. Is someone in the room? I hear like clicking and stuff.
It's my dog. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Okay, I guess I can't. Well, if we're going to hear the dog, you got to show us the dog at least.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, here. One sec. This is Stormy.
Stormy. Okay, that's a great name.
Yeah. Exactly. Here, I'll take away the clicking. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries.
All right.
Okay, cool. Yeah, man. I mean, so like commercializing, starting small, using small farms to get started, ski resorts. Ski resorts are doing cloud seeding as well. Are they outputting silver iodide into the atmosphere using their machines to create snow? Mm-hmm.
So there are like generators from the ground that release silver iodide or potassium iodide into like a convective updraft that pulls that stuff from the ground up into clouds. Most of the snow that you see being created at ski resorts isn't like from cloud seeding or from like natural or artificial precipitation. It's that like, you know, those pipes that spray mist basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like the reason why you get this really granular icy snow, fake snow from those machines is just because it's fake, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's not actual precipitation. So what you can offer them is like nicer quality snow rather than just the sort of garbage that they blow out from those machines.
And the plan would be to like get drones up in the atmosphere and just anytime it detects like the right conditions, it would just release the silver iodide.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's also worth saying like silver iodide, you know, I'm saying salts and silver iodide, like chemical stuff that people might worry about poisoning the water or like hurting the environment beneath it. Silver iodide is biologically inert, right? So it's worth pointing out that there's like no ecological impact from this besides where the precipitation goes.
I was reading that the amounts of silver found like silver is just naturally occurring everywhere. And it's really just a few grams of real silver being put into the atmosphere. And then it's not even like above baseline when they test the earth, you know, it's just not increased too much.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and if you think about it, right, like it's kilograms being launched into a cloud that's precipitating over acres and acres, right? So if you sprinkle dust, you know, biologically inert dust, then you're not going to have any serious impact. And, you know, studies by the California EPA have proven this out. Studies by the EPA and like U.S. Weather Modification Bureau all have shown this in the past. So it's not like an unproven speculatory idea that this won't hurt the environment. Like it will not.
Mm-hmm. So in one of your recent Substacks, you were talking about marginal land and the California water supply strategy and how that with the strategy, it was what, like a million acres will be denied water access? What's up
with that? Yeah, what is up with that, man? it's somewhere between, okay, so for context, the state of California's official plan to mitigate drought in the next two decades involves allowing for 500,000 to 1.5 million acres of farmland to just turn into desert, basically, which is like bonkers.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah. And so in addition to that, like we're doing other stuff that's just nuts, like the Klamath River Dam. It's one of like the biggest dams, one of the biggest reservoirs in California. It's being deconstructed. Like they're spending $500 million to destroy a dam that provides consistent access to water for Northern Californian farmers, right? So not only are we planning to allow drought conditions to worsen, we're actively destroying infrastructure that is preventing the worsening of the drought.
Why are they destroying that infrastructure?
There's something called Delta smelt, which is this species of fish that they say has been negatively affected by dams. And, you know, like they say the same thing about salmon in some cases. And like, I'm all for helping like natural species, indigenous species thrive. Like, I think that it's better when we make the environment better. But there's cases of us building what are called salmon steps around dams. Have you ever heard of these?
Yeah, because salmon can just jump upstream.
Exactly. They can just jump upstream. And so salmon can, you can make these salmon steps for salmon to climb up a dam so that you don't obstruct their path. And there's some speculation about exactly how effective it is. But there's other models that like the Netherlands have proven out that are not exclusively usable by salmon. There's solutions that we can build to accommodate for the needs of fish and the needs of natural flora and fauna without destroying like what humans rely on. So yeah, there's all of these things in the work that are actively reducing the amount of access that the amount of water access that we'll have in California and the West, right? And what's really striking about it is all of the talk that we have about drought and water scarcity now basically parallels all the talk that was going on in the 1920s. The difference between now and then, though, is in the 1920s, people realized, okay, there's not enough water for us to irrigate all this land. There's not enough water to get all of the people in our city over the next 10 years access to water. So what we'll do is we'll just build more infrastructure to provide more water, right? Yeah. Like super intuitive.
Yeah.
Like if you have a supply demand issue, you increase supply. Our reaction now is to reduce demand with, you know, destroying millions of acres of farmland. I think that we're planning on getting rid of 500 million square feet of turf. And so like no more lawns are allowed. It has to be like rocks and astroturf and like, you know, low flow toilets, other sorts of stuff. Again, I think like efficiency is really good and symbiosis between humans and the environment is really good. But what we ought to do is like take a lesson from the people in the 20s through the 70s, essentially, that did things like build the California Water Project, right? So the State Water Project, it's different than, it solves for different needs than what we have to solve for now. And so far as it didn't produce more water, it just transferred water from water abundant Northern California, like 200 miles south through the Central Valley to LA and to Orange County. That was awesome. And that's great. Like we have these huge, you should look up the Edmonston pumping plant.
Okay.
I don't know if you put like graphics in the pod or anything.
Yeah.
But if you look up the Edmonston pumping plant, it's this huge plant with, I think, like 48,000 horsepower engines. And they pump water.
For the people on YouTube, yeah, I'm sharing pictures of it. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so exactly. So it pumps water, I think like 2,000 feet over mountains, the Tehachapi Mountains, to get it from the Central Valley into Los Angeles.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That's insane engineering.
Yeah. So there's that. And like a lot of the water that gets into San Francisco is pumped from the Sierra Nevadas and Lake Tahoe way west, like I think 100 miles west. So that just goes to say, like, or like the Hoover Dam too, right? Another awesome piece of engineering from that era. Like, that just goes to say that when people face water scarcity, there's two options, right? Like, it's the choice that we're choosing now, which is the which is the Malthusian, destructive, reducing consumption, maybe like solar punk model. And then there's the Terrapunk model, right? Which is to find engineering and financial solutions to produce more water, to get more access to water. So,
Did you see, so there's, you know, so one solution is like cloud seeding. Did you see Casey Handmeir's, well, you were tweeting about it, the desalinating ocean water using solar panels? I was like halfway through that right before this podcast. What'd you think about that?
I think it's awesome. I think that replenishing the Colorado River from like huge scale desal would be great. There is something to be said though for like blanketing the Imperial Valley with solar panels, you know? Mm-hmm. So like the ecological impact would be really cool. Making water more abundant would be really cool. Destroying the environment in one area for the sake of it in another though.
Yeah, it's not like that classic picture of the solar panels on the mountain. Here, let me pull this up on YouTube as well. I think this is in China, but solar panels. Let me share tab. Yeah, this picture of all these solar panels.
Exactly.
That's like the classic solar punk picture. But I mean, Casey's point still stands, is that solar energy is definitely getting cheaper. Maybe in the future, like there's nuclear energy that we can use, something like that.
Yeah. Exactly, dude. Like, if we can solve nuclear, we live in a totally different reality.
Yeah. If we're energy abundant, yeah, then we're totally desaling all the water, getting that.
Exactly. Well, and so, you know, like, this kind of brings up Casey's proposal, brings up, like, another interesting dynamic when you're talking about water abundance. And it's the large-scale infra versus small-scale decentralized infra debate, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I think that some huge canal from like the Mississippi River to the Colorado to fill up the Colorado would be awesome. Mm-hmm. Or desalinating with these like giga plants to supply all of our needs would be really cool. There's something to be said though for like what we can do right now. And like, we should push for those really cool big ones. But also there's companies like, or Epic Cleantech, if you've heard of them, and they do decentralized water recycling. Right. And so what they offer is an opportunity for every building to recycle 50 to 90% of their potable water for reuse. Right. So that is a really viable path, I think, without dealing with all of the ossified bureaucracy to producing water abundance. Right. Like, if we have decentralized, small modular desalination plants, then every farm can be autonomous. Right. If we have every building using one of these recycling plants, then they can be semi-autonomous. Cloud seeding is also really cool because it's low capex, even relatively low opex compared to some of these plants. And you don't get like what happened with the Poseidon desalination plant in Huntington Beach recently. Did you hear about this?
No, I didn't hear about this.
So, you know, Poseidon Water Company said, hey, we would love to build you this huge desalination plant. It'll do 50,000 acre feet of water per year. For context, an acre foot is what it sounds like. It's how much water it would take to cover an acre in 1 feet of water. It's equal to like 300,000 gallons. They said, yeah, we would love to build you this plant. Like, we have all the money ready. We have the financing ready. The engineers are good to go. They ended up spending 6 years and $100 million on ecological studies just to prove that the brine wouldn't like kill everything in the ocean nearby. And then the Coastal Commission, the California Coastal Commission, still said, no, sorry, like, we don't want it.
Even though they proved that it wouldn't actually hurt.
Yeah. And the reason that they gave was that if water levels rise 4 feet, then the pump will be, then the desal plant will be semi-submerged in water. And like, if water levels rise 4 feet, then we have way bigger problems than one desal plant being submerged, right?
Then, like, years into the future, how many years into the future are they thinking that might happen?
Like a couple decades, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Dude, that's crazy.
Yeah, dude, it's nuts. It's wild. So like part of the discussion too, which is a part that I'm really interested to hear your take on, is like, how do you change messaging and how do you change public opinion on like whether water has to be something that is scarce and whether like human intervention in the environment necessarily is like destructive?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing that actually comes to mind is there's this on Twitter, people have been talking about like this TikTok trend about when people go to Europe and then they come back to America and they're like, the first half of the video is like, oh, miss Europe, whatever. It was so romantic. And then they come back to America and they're like, fuck yeah, abundant showers, like blast my AC, like all that stuff. Sure. Like just using everything. I think that's definitely different than what I grew up with the messaging of like, you know, take a 5-minute shower kind of thing. And so like making those kind of videos, like, I don't know, just liking those kind of videos. I think another thing is like, that makes it tough is, you know, Bill Gates has been doing his weather modification and people just naturally kind of do not like that. And I think you gotta maybe do like, I think it's just tough for everyone to understand the environment is so big. So it's like, if you could do a scaled down environment, like, could you take like a warehouse and create clouds or something and show people that's cool? Like maybe make a viral video like that. How do you change the messaging? I don't know. I think like, you know, I made that salt and sea video about, cause I was just, you were asking about this and that was just, I tweeted, I'm going to write a thread on how to terraform the salt and sea. Cause I'm kind of obsessed with the salt and sea. It's, you know, the sea's declining. It was originally caused by the Colorado River. A dam burst and then it flooded the basin. I'm sure you know this. And then now it used to be abundant. There was tourism, but now it's all evaporating and high salinity, toxic algae blooms, and there's asthma everywhere. And so I was like, okay, I just posted this tweet and I was like, how do you terraform the salt and sea? And I was just like, started to make this story about these two engineers that moved to the salt and sea. I think they buy a boat, they start seeding clouds. The wind above California pushes the clouds towards the Salton Sea, and then it starts raining there. It brings water. That way you don't have to build like a massive pipeline. I'm not sure how expensive that would be, but like maybe the cloud seeding is cheaper. And then like, oh, how do we monetize this? Because, you know, if it's a startup and engineers, I was like, maybe Australia, you know, their coral reefs are getting bleached because there's a lack of clouds. And so I was like, maybe if you can get Australia to pay you to create clouds to prevent the coral bleaching, then you'll get money and they'll increase their tourism. And then I was like, okay, where else do you need clouds? Maybe, what was it, the North Pole? Like, so you create clouds over the North Pole, slow glaciers, and maybe some world economic group pays you for that. I don't know who. But sure, I was going like kind of big scale, but I was just thinking like, those are the kind of stories that I want to see instead of like just like a hurricane movie or like, what was that movie, 2012, where there was just a massive storm and it bulldozes our place. Like,
yeah, exactly.
you gotta have the terraforming stories. Like Red Mars is an example of, it's a trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson, and they go to Mars and they terraform Mars over these three books. And I think that's really cool. I haven't finished the trilogy, so I don't know how optimistic it is, because I know some of his writing isn't exactly Terrapunk, but just creating more art, maybe like using Midjourney. Have you been playing around with Midjourney or creating art around this?
My Twitter banner, like my Twitter background is a Midjourney image. I think the prompt was like abundant water infrastructure terraforming the desert or something like that.
Okay, we gotta pull this up now for those. This is why you gotta watch on YouTube. Let's see. Okay, Augustus. That's pretty
cool. Exactly. So the idea of being like having so much water pumped in from one of these enormous pipelines that you like create inland seas or inland lakes, basically. Mm-hmm.
Create a bunch of salt and seas.
Yeah. Like why not, right? And maybe the answer is like, well, there's some ecological benefits to having, you know, mm-hmm. deserts and desert wildlife, but also there have been phases between, you know, now the ice age before then, where different areas of the globe had different environments, right? Like we before had times when America or North America was way more lush, right? Mm-hmm. So like we can, if we're shrewd about it, like if we take the green wall of China as an example, mm-hmm. and improve upon their model, create way more lush areas in the country, like in the Mojave, right? Like the big tweet that sort of blew up of mine is like, no, babe, I can't come to bed. I'm scheming with the boys about how to create abundant water to terraform the Mojave.
Dude, I think that was the first time I saw your tweets. That was a great tweet.
Nice. Thanks. Yeah. But yeah, like, because the Salton Sea is great, but it's like it's a salty body of water, right? So there's some limitations on what wildlife can exist there. There's no reason why we couldn't, or there are reasons why it would be difficult, but there's no reason why it's impossible to create, you know, Salton Sea like that in Arizona. And by the way, you brought up before, like, how expensive would it be to replenish the Salton Sea with like a desalination plant and pipeline? The super conservative estimates are like $50 billion.
Is that from Casey's thing?
No, that's not Casey. Okay. There's actually a handful of people that have like been talking about this in the undercurrents of California water discussions.
Mm. See, and that's $50 billion. And so that's why I was thinking, like, I don't know. I you know, you need to develop the tech, but it's like, can you just take a boat out into the ocean and then use wind currents to, so like you take the boat, you get a machine that sprays silver iodide and salt, and then it, I don't know, it would need to go high enough or something, and then it just uses wind. Or do you think like you'd want to use a drone, or what would your method be to get all that water over there?
Well, what you're talking about is like a whole new level of cloud seeding operations than what like currently exists, right? Like creating clouds themselves, totally doable. I don't even know if you necessarily need to do that to recover the Salton Sea, though, for like a reasonable price point. Like there is enough cloud coverage over the course of the year in the drainage basin of the Salton Sea that you can just cause those clouds to precipitate before they flow out over the Pacific. And just by causing that cloud water to become rainwater, you can solve for this problem. I think that like the number that's thrown around about that is something more like $15 million a year, which is way easier to finance, especially if it's economically, like if it's improving the area's economic condition with tourism, with agriculture, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm.
And you were saying something that surprised me when we first started talking, is that California is actually pretty pro cloud seeding.
Interestingly, yes.
Yeah.
So the Sacramento Municipal Utility District and a couple other areas, like Santa Barbara's water district, and I'm forgetting one more, but they have really small token cloud seeding operations that increase the amount of, so in the case of Sacramento, they increase the amount of snowpack at the top of the American Rivers watershed by 5 to 10% per year. That's a lot of water for context. Like that's hundreds of thousands of acre feet for something like hundreds of thousands of dollars in OPEX.
That's you insane.
Yeah, exactly. And that's using these super old Cessnas with like a guy flying around looking for a good cloud, like no artificial intelligence directing where this goes and like when to release the salts for optimal seeding conditions.
Like he's just like on his gut, like this is a good cloud. I mean, he has some instruments.
Yeah, like essentially. And yeah, there's meteorologists on the ground that will like call up the guys at the airstrip and say, hey, you know, looks like there's a good one coming down. And then the guy will fly up, do reconnaissance, be like, yeah, no, I'm going to send it. And this is the case in like North Dakota too, where they do it. And in Mexico and Texas, there's a couple small operations, but it's mostly just guys like looking at a screen, seeing a cloud come their way, fly up and like hit it.
You got to make like a TikTok of like free bird, like like just some dude cloud seeding.
yeah.
That's like what's in my mind. Like he's playing while he's doing all this. Dude, that's yeah. It's so funny how kind of low tech it is. So,
yeah. Well, and so like whether it's cloud seeding or, you know, decentralized desalination or decentralized water recycling or like improved efficiency in groundwater metering and production, like there are very simple technological solutions with a very low price point that have outsized returns for human economic use of water and also environmental enhancement via water. Like, it's totally attainable.
So how many, I want to kind of shift, like, how has tweeting helped you? Like, have you met a lot of people? I saw that you were tweeting about, like, you want a drone. Like, how can you get a drone? And there were a few comments underneath, like, hey, man, if you're serious, I can actually help you. Like, what has Twitter done for you lately?
Dude, my friend from Twitter, actually.
Aaron, they're all friends. Yeah.
Exactly. We're all friends, aren't we? F-R-E-N-S. Friends. Like, he tweeted something that said, like, publishing your work and tweeting about your work will increase your luck stat by 10 or something like that.
10x.
Yeah. 10x. Magnitude. In my case, it's been like 100x. Like, first of all, we're talking because of it, which is awesome. I found the Terrapunk Manifesto, which, if your listeners haven't read already, they should, because it's super base. Found that via Twitter. That tweet that I put out that you referenced, where I was like, hey, where can I get like a military UAV? People commented, and I ended up having a conversation, like an IRL conversation over coffee with one guy who said, you know, like, anything is basically attainable because I have this military background. Anything's attainable in the US. But let me put you in contact with one of my friends. He's a war dog in Turkey and Bolivia. Like, he's an arms dealer. And he could probably get you either a cannon or a drone a lot cheaper and with a lot less red tape than in America. Oh. Yeah. So that was pretty cool.
What's the price point on that?
For the drones or for the howitzer or
for the drone?
For the really big UAV type drones, it's like $500,000 plus, usually getting up closer to like high seven figures. For a howitzer, though, or not necessarily a howitzer, but like the Turkish equivalent of such an artillery piece, it's lower, more like hundreds of thousands. Consistently hundreds of thousands.
Have you met any like investors who are like, dude, when you start cloud seeding or terraforming, like, hit me up?
Yeah, it's been super hot. I've gotten a lot of inbound about this venture and also just about TerraSeco. And also, by the way, investors, if you're listening, no, we're not taking checks because we're already scaling and profitable at TerraSeco. So I'm happy to have those conversations for our Series A, though.
I mean, I kind of glazed over TerraSeco in the beginning, but how long have you been working on that? And how's it going? Like, you've fully automated this and now it's just kind of a marketing thing, or?
Yeah, it's a scaling thing. So we started full time in August when I dropped out of Cal, dropped out of UC Berkeley.
Nice.
Yep. Had one class left, but the aesthetic of being a dropout seemed a lot cooler than a degree. So started doing that full time, fleshed out MVP, launched in August, and we were working on whether, you know, the market size would justify being a vertical SaaS company or if we should stick to like a consultancy. So over the summer and the fall, we were figuring that out and ended up conclusively deciding SaaS, vertical SaaS. And we've got 100 or so clients. We have back orders in the dozens. So that feels good. It's interesting. I've never scaled a company before. My co-founder has a super successful well drilling business, but it's not, you know, venture scale. So this has been a learning experience for both he and I.
What did you learn? Like, what's the biggest learning?
I think and maybe this is trite because people in the startup space talk about it all the time, but like, really just iterate faster than you think you ought to. Just do whatever you think that you can do in the most minimum viable form in the smallest possible amount of time, because you can get feedback either, you know, if you're shipping a new feature, you can get feedback from your customers faster. If you're trying to do marketing, like we're using MailChimp for marketing campaigns, and we're doing like this circuit of groundwater conventions, actually, which exists, which I encourage you to attend sometime. They're a different scene. The faster that you can iterate your product, your marketing, your go-to-market strategy, your sales pitch, the faster you get like data with which you can improve all of those things. So
yeah, I mean, it's one of those obvious things, but it's like, until you experience it, you don't fully internalize it.
Yeah. You know, it's like lifting. Anybody can tell you to lift, but like, until you start throwing weight around, you don't really get why everyone tells you to lift.
And you don't understand that, wow, you can actually change your body. you can actually like terraform your body, like make it jack, yeah. like change yourself. It's such a powerful feeling. How have your lifts been going lately? Because your Twitter bio says DM me for deadlift to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I definitely have foregone some gains in favor of like focusing on the company. So
it's bullish. Very bullish.
Yeah. 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 So I plateaued my deadlift max at 485. I plateaued my bench max at 295, those are both two horrible numbers to stop at because I'm just short of 5 3/8. So hopefully in the coming months, I'll pivot back to focusing on that. Still have a 4-plate squat. So that feels pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah. How's lifting been for you, man?
I'm on the road to 3-plate bench as well. So nice. I'm working on that. I think I hit 260 the other day. I have all these random weight. So I forget the exact number, but I think it was 260. My back kind of hurts, which is just the lamest thing. And so I don't squat or deadlift like nearly heavy enough. And it just hurts me. It's just like internally, it's just like, damn, I wish I could go harder on that. But so I run a lot for that. Yeah. My military press is the thing that I like the most. And I was doing a plate plus 25 on that.
Yeah. 185 is a pretty respectable military press.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my favorite one.
You know, what's funny. I don't know. Like I make no claim to be like I won't even go down that tangent. I will say though, among people that I have met, right. Mm-hmm. In the founder space, in the tech space, in the water space, my anecdotal experience is that there's like a pretty strong positive correlation between like character, success, being cool, being funny, and like your deadlift max or your bench max, like how much you actually lift. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in water abundance or becoming a better person or like building a startup, you should start by building your body.
Your posterior chain is also your, you know, how strong your back is how strong your character is.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I have a friend, Peter Master, and he's floated the idea for a long time of opening a venture fund that exclusively cuts checks to people that could bench 315.
I saw this. I'm much more bullish on the 315 fund than like the sober fund that somebody else was like, I'm only going to invest in sober founders. I'm like, I want somebody who can bench 315, you know, after drinking heavy the night before. It's just like, oh yeah, man, it's just easy reps.
Totally. So do you disqualify natty or non-natties from that? Or
I think if they're using like roids or something, I think they're curious. And I mean, these aren't strong beliefs, but they're curious, they're driven, they're going to get what they want. They're going to get the gains regardless of, you know, personal cost. And I think that's might be what it takes to be a founder.
Dude. Yeah. Same, totally same vibe. I want to have like a big family. My girlfriend and I talk about having like 9 kids or something.
Nice.
So pronatalism is a cool tangent.
Big
too,
on pronatalism. I want to do some podcasts on artificial wombs at some point. Very controversial, but
I would say satanic. Personally, I would label that satanic.
Yeah. you guys see where the tech's at.
I think it's
interesting. Yeah.
Did you hear about the like chimera babies in China?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of those?
No strong opinion. I heard about it, but I don't know exactly what's going on there.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know precisely what it is either, but something to the effect of like half human, half pig embryos or something.
Oh, wow. It's kind of, that reminds me of like the Colossus doing the woolly mammoth. So they're using elephant wombs and then implanting woolly mammoth embryos or DNA. And then it creates like a mammoth that can go terraform the tundra just by stomping around.
How far along is that?
Well, I think they either just raised their Series A or Series B. I think it was B because they were definitely out there talking about money, but I don't know what the tech's at. I don't think they're super public about that.
Interesting.
As far as I know. I know it's like it's related with George Church and everything, but I think that's a really cool like terraforming like mindset is like, yeah, let's just revive extinct animals, but also, you know, kind of go beyond that and make like new animals. Like, I think technology needs to get to the point where I can have a baby Yoda just like walking around my house. Like, it doesn't have to be sentient, but like, just give me like change a dog or something into a baby Yoda and like nice. And combine it with a few other things. But I think that'd be pretty sick.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, like the EAC guys on Twitter,
mm-hmm.
effective acceleration.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they've done a great job in messaging, right? And I look to them when I think about how to change the messaging around water, because they have made like AI research, and they made AI research super cool, and like accelerating AI research super cool in this like niche of techno optimism. And I think that like, whether it's, you know, like biological engineering or like water infra engineering or something like this, we just need to like return to a pre like nuclear scare era of wanting to like, you know, terraform the earth, go to the stars. Like, you know, it's funny, the death of cloud seeding sort of occurred simultaneously with the death of like the space program in the 70s and 80s. You know, like as we transitioned to the space shuttle, we also transitioned away from cloud seeding. And I think that that sort of speaks to, you know, and I wrote about this in my last Substack post that you mentioned, like, as much as it is a technical problem that we need to solve, and as much as anything that we face, any problem that we face is a technical problem that we need to solve, like, it's also a civilizational spiritual problem, right? Like, do we feel as though we as a society are worthy of and deserving of improving the world around us, right? Like, are we capable of improving the world around us, and should we? And I think that that's been lost, and that's something that I definitely want to focus on.
I think a lot of people don't feel worthy. Like, they don't feel like who's to say, like, I should have all that power, which, I mean, you know, who should have all that power, but, you know, humanity collectively, like, should be able to do these kind of things. That's why I don't know if I'll stay with it, but currently my podcast name is Nasdaq Futurism, and it's FVTRISM, and it's like future and return, like RVTRN.
Mm-hmm.
So like return kind of to the past, you know, traditional values maybe, but like also return to the moon landing and that kind of era of inspiration in the futurism, like tech. And then I was also thinking like FVTR could be like the stock ticker of the future, like, you know, invest in the future. Like, are you bullish on the future? Like that kind of thing. So it's like
that's
futurism.
Base.
So it's a lot to explain though. If somebody new is coming to the podcast and you share it with like your friend and like Nasdaq future, like how do you even type that or something? Like, so you got to explain it a little bit, but it might be kind of cool enough.
Yeah.
At the minimum, I should make like t-shirts about it. Like some
totally, totally. Yeah, no, I mean, the ethos is killer regardless of how you feel about the branding. And it's kind of funny, like people talk about like Dryden Brown from Praxis. I think Brown is his last name.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Dryden talks about how like we can't just return, right? Like the Ted Kaczynski model of like returning to nature is
doesn't work.
Not it, you know?
Yeah.
Like we have to return to what you're talking about, which is like to an optimistic civilization, to a creative and generative civilization which is like a futuristic thing, right? We had it in the past. We need to go back to the past to create the future. And there's sort of an interesting like biblical allusion there, which is like trying to go back to Eden versus trying to bring down to earth the New Jerusalem, right?
Mm.
Like God, like in Revelation, right? I'm Christian, by the way, but in Revelation, right? Like John, who is having these prophetic visions, doesn't say like, and then the earth became the Garden of Eden again, right? Like he talked about a street that was lined with gold, with like abundant trees with fruit all around them, right? Mm. Like there is a city in the future that has aspects of like our holier past that we have to forge.
But like the gold streets are like technology, you know, it's like technology, we can rebuild it, but it's slightly different, but it's still like we're paying respect to Eden.
Yeah, totally, dude. Well, I mean, like Gold Street's literally like the decadence of Los Angeles or something are not what we need.
Yeah. Roth Ducat, yeah. The decadent society. Totally. We don't need that. But at the same time, I mean, we should have so many materials that we can. Every street could be gold if we wanted to. Just from like all the asteroids or all the planets. We find a gold planet somewhere and we bring back all the gold or something, you know? Like
honestly, yeah. No, true. There's something kind of interesting though, which is like, I think part of the reason why we have this sort of like gluttonous, decadent, lazy, non-generative, non-creative spirit in our society is like because of how abundant like entertainment is, right?
Or
like easy access, distractions or like really gross food from like McDonald's that's full of seed oil and like phytoestrogens and garbage like that, right? How do we like ensure that we have abundance without becoming gluttons? You know, like what do you think about that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think McDonald's, you can go look at that picture of the workers in like the 90s and they're like all super thin and healthy. And that was when they use tallow, cow fat. And tallow has more stearic acid, so there's a good story here. And basically, you know, squirrels will eat acorns to prepare for the winter and to hibernate. And bears, and so acorns have high linoleic acid. And bears will also eat foods that are high in linoleic acid as well. And both of these examples are examples of slowing your metabolism using high linoleic acid. And linoleic acid is in seed oils, in canola oil, vegetable oil, that kind of thing. And interestingly, the Native Americans would not hunt bears before they would hibernate, which is when they were the fattest. And you'd think that they would hunt the bears then. But they would hunt them after hibernation in spring, after the bears had gotten thinner. Or if they had to hunt them, they would take the fat and boil off the linoleic acid that was accumulated on their body. And so the remaining product is stearic acid. And so stearic acid is the opposite of linoleic acid. It's found in tallow, coconut oil, some in olive oil, ghee. And basically it increases your metabolism. And so it makes you burn more energy, it makes you more energetic. And so the way you can tell if a oil has high stearic acid is how solid it is at room temperature, because coconut oil is more solid, tallow is more solid, that kind of thing. And so you want to eat those kind of foods. But I think that the reason that like McDonald's, we have all these phytoestrogens, this kind of thing, is just because at the time it was cheaper to use those, and so it was like a capitalism thing. But like if you can create ways to create these oils or like extract them or whatever to make it cheaper, then I mean companies will switch back to it. It's also kind of like a marketing thing that you have to tell people so that people use it. But I feel like, you know, seed oil disrespecter, there's a lot of people out there that are promoting that kind of thing, and I think eventually it'll start flipping. I think it comes down to cost, so like that's why it happened, and then we got to get rid of that. But then there are also things like phytoestrogens in the water. I definitely don't know how to fix that other than like trying to just avoid it. And that's the same kind of thing with like all the entertainment is like, yeah, I'm certainly guilty of, I love it. Like I love watching movies. I love TikTok. I love all that kind of stuff. But it's also like, okay, dude, you got to focus sometimes. So it's just, that's like a moderation kind of thing.
Sure. You know, so two interesting things. One, if anybody is interested in like avoiding phytoestrogens and getting clean water and PFAS out of your water. PFAS are like this new poison that we've realized we've been pumping into the water for decades. Orange County, California is building 35 PFA treatment plants to get this both out of the groundwater. So like they've found that the percolating water from the rivers and the rain has PFAS in it. And then when they pump it out of the ground, it's also poison. Yeah. Yeah. So they're both treating the water that's already like in the system and also pumping water up out of the ground, treating it and then pumping it back down. So if you want to look at like a way that we're super vitally improving water quality and like improving the environment, Orange County's crushing it in that respect. And there's a handful of companies that are also doing stuff like this. But the other sort of broader idea that you brought up that I wanted to touch on was like, in order to change society, in order to like get away from seed oils, you need to make viable, cheaper alternatives, right? Like you need to align incentives you need to align like capital's incentives with vital incentives. And what like that sort of gets into the territory of is the question of like, what should founders be working on, right? Like, what problems should people be trying to solve? And the typical like clowned on field is like SaaS, right? Like you're working in B2B SaaS, you're like some productivity tool or something like this, or maybe like you're some super smart guy that just got out of like, you know, an elite university that chose to work in finance, that's trading like fourth layer derivatives and just like speculating, right? There is value to like the financial system. There's value to B2B SaaS and productivity tools. But I think a lot more people that have the agency to build something and to like use their intellectual capacity to build something new have to make the trade and have to make the choice not to pursue what seems like the path of least resistance and building some SaaS tool or some, or taking some like finance career, but instead being the guy that makes tallow more affordable than seed oil, right? Or being the guy that like chooses to make it cheaper and more sensible just to produce more water than to restrict the amount of water that people have, or being the guy that chooses to like, you know, blast through all of the red tape and create modular nuclear reactors or something like that, right?
Yeah, and this is what Samo Berger was talking about, is like, it, we have brain drain between countries, but we also have brain drain between sectors. And it's like, you gotta figure out incentives to reverse that. Or, I mean, hopefully, you know, one of the things that I wanna like tell like younger people on TikTok, like this is, so for context, like, I got into being NASDAQ because I initially read like Paul Graham's essays, and like that's how I got into startups, I mean. And I read Paul Graham's essays, and he had this essay about you can fix up a car and then it's worth more. And then he also was talking about, you know, as a founder, you just have leverage in your equity. Like you just have infinite upside instead of recurring upside. And that, and then I also saw like David Dobrik vlogs, funny enough. And those were super fun. And Walter Isaacson always talks about the combination of art and science. So I was like, how can I combine these ideas? Anyways, but yeah, I mean, sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought. We
were talking about like the, you brought up Samo's point about the brain drain between industries and like, how do you get people to do like vital things?
So my thought here is like, okay, if I'm on TikTok, I can like talk to kind of maybe high schoolers, will watch the content. And then like they'll be interested in engineering, maybe already, maybe they'll get more interested. And then they learn about startups, they go to university, they're engineers or whatever. They know that startups are an opportunity. You know, maybe they drop out and they're like, look, I gotta call NASDAQ. Like, let me talk to him. Let me see what he's doing. Maybe he'll know somebody that can help or whatever. But like, I just want more people to know that that's like an option, is just building startups and like making money is like good. Actually.
Yeah. That's like another one of the very base layer battles that we have to fight, right?
Yeah.
It's okay to have money. Like, we don't all have to be poor.
Yeah. You don't have to flagate yourself, you know?
Like, exactly. Right. So actually, like, what was the path? Can you flesh out the path to becoming NASDAQ? Like, the path to deciding that you were going to break the mold and like do podcasting type stuff, talk about vitalism, talk about terraforming, like all of these very like third rail decisions compared to the typical career path of people.
Totally. So I was a chemical engineer in university, and I guess I chose chemical engineering when I was in high school. I was in Calgary, and I went to this private school, and all the kind of wealthy people that I kind of looked up to were in oil because of the Calgary oil sands. And they were chemical engineers, and I learned, I was like, okay, if I do chemical engineering, I can basically do anything. Like, I can go into physics, whatever, but not the other way around. Physics can't go into chemical engineering. So I did that really to preserve optionality. But when I was in chemical engineering, one story I tell is that I was playing soccer, and I ended up breaking my foot and sprained my ankle because some dude landed on my foot. This is kind of the long way around this story, but I took an exam the next day, passed it, did really well, like with only like 3 hours studying. But then the next day I was like, okay, I'm just chilling in bed. and I read The Martian in just a day, and I felt like I was in Mars. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to start reading all these like NASA research papers. So I got like super interested in just like creating oxygen on Mars, like bacteria on Mars, colonizing Mars, that kind of thing. And anyway, so I ended up even like changing my capstone project to like a Mars thing, which is, capstone is like the final engineering project. So anyways, I graduate university. I had read Paul Graham and I was kind of like, what am I going to do with my life? And I knew for sure that I did not want to go work at a company for 30 years. And like, I know this is becoming more common now, but like at the time I was kind of concerned about that. And so I was like, okay, I have no clue what I'm going to do. So where's the coolest place in the States? Because I went to a Canadian university and my decision was the Tesla Gigafactory. And so I drove to Nevada and just talked my way into a job at the Tesla Gigafactory. I was working for like one of the contractors, but I started working there and it was just like kind of inspiring being around like the manufacturing hub-ish. Like I remember walking through one of the areas and I look and I see these like this bigger than a football field and it's like these columns and there's like welders like up at the top and on rafters mm-hmm. and it looked very like futuristic. There was like a big X kind of there. That was very inspiring. Anyways, giving a lot of details, but like then no. I was like, okay, I'm leaving. I had applied to some grad schools, but then eventually I decided that wasn't for me. I went back to Texas. I started a startup in solar panels. I was trying to do like a smart data kind of thing. It's to sell solar panels, but then I was like, okay, this isn't. I met some other founders that were Y Combinator founders, and I ended up joining their startup very early on. And I would work for them and I would do like the manufacturing supply chain kind of thing, some engineering. And then in my free time, I started making NASDAQ content. And so around that same time was when I had been watching like David Dobrik vlogs and Paul Graham essays were slightly before that, Walter Isaacson books, combination of art and science. And I was like, okay, maybe there's like being a creator is a pretty viable path. I had been making YouTube videos before that, but then I was like, hey, let's just try TikTok. And so I ended up making a video about SpaceX when Elon presented the Starship architecture for the first time back in like 2019. And that video, so I like was like, so here's what happened. Elon presented this and it's a terrible video, but like it went viral. It got like 300K views. And I was like, okay, screw YouTube. TikTok is the place to be. And so I doubled down on like, I made like 5 Starship videos. And then I kept making videos and then eventually I got like a 15K brand deal and I was like, okay, I'm quitting. Let's start full-time NASDAQ. And then, yeah. So the idea is like, if I can become a creator, I can make money, meet people and invest in people and, you know, inspire people to create startups, create engineering, make the world better, talk to really cool people, that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, kind of all. That's kind of like the early stories of NASDAQ. There's plenty of other stories, you know, as NASDAQ, but that's kind of how it came to be.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sure there's lots of other stories. I know it's impolite to ask a lady their age, but how old are you?
How old do you think I am?
You give off like a 20, 25, 26 vibe, I would say.
Okay, good, good. I'm 28 now. I just turned 28 recently. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's been... So yeah, it's been since 2019 that I really started. I started my YouTube channel 2018, but 2019 is when TikTok popped off, and then 2020 is when I quit my job, and then it's been a whole ride. But it's like there's been setbacks in terms of, you know, some setbacks, but like, you know, it's just keep moving forward, and nobody can take away like the audience and people that I've met and all that kind of stuff. So
totally.
Just keep going. Yeah. And so the podcast is like, okay, I can talk to people. I can put podcasts out there, kind of create like a dope network of people that I meet. Eventually I have a studio. I'd like to hire an editor and like, then I'll just have kind of like base layer, like revenue because TikTok's hard to monetize. So I need to figure out YouTube. And so I want to do that. And then I can kind of do things on top of the podcast as well. Like maybe I go vlog and like meet some startups and like, that's the, because I want to make TikToks to promote each podcast. So like I make a short video. So I think for this one, for example, while we were talking and we were talking about the cloud seeding guy listening to Freebird, I think I might have like a clip of you kind of describing and like Freebird like slowly ramping up in the background and then like just some planes like fly through. And then like at the end, I want to be like, if you want to learn more about cloud seeding or whatever, check out the podcast. So I want to do that kind of stuff, but like I could go out and like vlog with people and that kind of stuff.
Totally. Yeah, that totally makes sense. I you know, you mentioned setbacks. Not sure if this is like worth bringing up or not, but just to bond over mutual suffering, I also was in Beanstalk.
Bro. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I was referencing. I mean, for everyone that doesn't know, I had a run up in crypto. I started with like 20K and I turned it into 1.25 mil, which was in Beanstalk. And then Beanstalk got exploited. I mean, I still made other money outside of that, but like I had moved to Utah. I was completely isolated just so I could like focus and work and grind and stuff. And I had come back to Texas. I had met Elon at the Gigafactory Austin opening, which was super sick. And then my pods harvested, which means that I got, you know, 1.25 mil. And I was like on top of life. And then like, 2 days later, I was working on my taxes, and then I wake up the next morning and it's all gone. Luckily, I had withdrawn some for taxes and stuff. But like, So that took me. That's why I haven't posted in a while. It just like I was like, okay, let me just live life for a little bit, reset. But now I'm like, okay, podcast, let's get into it. And another thing is, I kept being hopeful that like our unripe stuff would come back. Because Beanstalk, for context, is like coming back. And I kept being like, okay, well, you know, I'll have that money back and then I can get the studio and the editor. Not that I need one point, you know, all that money for editor and a studio, but like, I was like, then I can do it right. And so it was like the hope was a little paralyzing, but it's coming back. But regardless, I'm like over it and excited for the podcast and that kind of stuff. But that was a long journey. That was a lot.
Well, you know, I love... This is also super cliche, but the Founders Podcast by David Senner.
I want to have him on.
Dude, that would be cool because he's just like an encyclopedia of knowledge. Mm-hmm. But like every single one of these guys, you know, whether it's like Henry Ford or Bezos or, you know, Elon, whoever, they get like beaten to pulp before they have their like big break. Or even after the big break, they're still like fighting to the death for their company. And eventually, like, you know, we have these overnight success stories or whatever, but it's heartening. Mm-hmm. It's heartening to hear about those stories of the people that made it after getting beat around.
Yeah, it's all about the journey. I mean, there's two things there. I mean, one thing that I thought of when it happened was like Ray Dalio got completely blown up in the early markets. He had a few mil and then he lost it all. And he was like, I sold my house. I sold my car. He like moved into a tiny apartment. And like now, you know, regardless of whatever you think of him, he's a billionaire. Big dude. Yeah. And then the other thing is like, yeah, man, it's just like perseverance stories, like just keep moving on and it'll all come back. I think there was something else, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, like tying it back to cloud seeding and like water abundance and this type of stuff, like the American narrative has lots of these stories, right? Like we had the revolution, we had the Civil War, we had the world wars. And so there's like these peaks and troughs in our nation's history. And like, I think now, or at least for a while, we've been in this trough where we feel super Malthusian. We feel like, you know, the country either isn't worth fighting for, or like we can't protect it because China's like floating spy balloons over us or something. And like all the kids are addicted to TikTok and we're like eating seed oils and all this stuff. And, you know, 1 million acres of farmland are going to disappear. So there's all this like super negative messaging. And, you know, I'm sure that like, some people online will be like, oh, like this is cope, like you're just coping. And it's like, I think that just in the same way that like in the story of Job, right? Job was tested by God like extremely severely and extremely harshly, like to glorify him, right? And to like make a story that could hearten other people, or like the story of Abraham, like being told by God to sacrifice his son, like this harrowing experience ultimately leading to like a more glorious ending than we would have had hadn't it been for all of the tribulation. Like, I think that, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, when we reflect on like the 2000s up to the 2010s and the 2020s and say like, you know, what were we thinking with water? We're going to look back so grateful at like where we've ended up because of how crazy things were and how little water we planned on having and how much we eventually have then, right? Like I want to look, you know, Eric Wahlberg, the head of community at Praxis, you know, runs a Frontier podcast. He always says at the end of the podcast, like, you know, when we're in 2035 in like our villa in the city or whatever, right? Like, what do you want to think about, talk about, like, what are the lessons learned? In, you know, 2050, I want to look at like the Mojave Desert and see like an abundant, like paradise, like farmland and forests and fields, and the Salton Sea will be totally swimmable. And there's going to be fish jumping out of the river that like feeds into it. You know, like I think it'll be really exciting in the 2050s if we can nail it in the 2020s. And that's what I'm hoping to do in water abundance. And that's why I love talking to people like you that also have a sort of like futuristic, optimistic vision.
I appreciate. Yeah, dude. I mean, out of hardness, like, comes opportunity and, you know, glory, like beauty, you know, that's when it's your time to shine and like really come through. And I mean, COVID was like a forcing function for everyone. There's a lot of TikToks now about people like being like, oh, I was so out of shape, like 2020. And then COVID happened and now it's like their glow up, like that. Like, it's just, that's a small example, but like, you know, COVID was a forcing function. There's a lot of forcing functions.
Yeah, dude, I was like a scrawny 160 pounds, you know, guy prior to COVID. And now I'm this big, hulking, mogging 210 pound menace.
Dude, nice. Thanks. About to bench three plates.
About to, exactly. You and I both, bro. You and I both.
Close. Yeah, man. Dude, yeah. I mean, it's been great to talking with you. I mean, I bet we could keep going, but like, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about, or do you think?
I think that we covered the bases, man. I just think it's really important that smart people, high agency people decide to pursue high impact careers, decide to pursue things that are, you know, aligned with capital incentives so that they can make money, so that they can have more influence, so that they can improve the world. I think it's really important that we make water abundant, but, you know, we talked about all those things already.
And like, and one last thing is like, you know, some people on TikTok might be like, who's Augustus? Like, who's this dude? But like, part of my goal is like finding cool people on Twitter. You know, like a good example is Garrett Scott with Pipe Dream, is that, you know, 2 years ago, he was insane for thinking he could do underground logistics. And now he like has these little robots going underground to deliver packages. But it's like, yeah. I want to have the big guests on too, like, you know, Mr. Beast or, you know, any big researcher or whatever. But I also want to like have you guys and like follow your story, because and like, you know, when you have clouds and stuff, like I want to, you know, have you back on and be like, bro, do you remember when we did that podcast and now you're here? And like, it's the journey. And then we can, you know, talk about the hardships and stuff.
Totally, man. Totally. Well, we won't be talking about that over a podcast. I'll bring you out when we're causing rain over the Gulf.
Yeah. Yes. We're going to film some cloud creation.
Exactly.
That'll be sick. Awesome. Awesome, man. Thanks for coming on. What do you want to promote? Your Substack?
Yeah, check out my Substack, Dorico, Dorico, .substack.com, and check out my Twitter, @Dorico is the handle.
Awesome. Awesome. So. And check me out, Nasjack__ on Twitter. And yeah, just follow the pod. And I'm excited to be back doing podcasting. This was super fun, and I can't wait to do more.
Let's awesome, go, bro.
Man.
Let's
Thanks, go. Man. Peace.
Later, man.
Cool. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. I do want everyone to know, as we discussed during the podcast, you know, beans, it was a lot. But the main point is I'm coming back and I'm very excited to. So if you enjoyed the podcast, definitely let me know. Drop a comment, tweet at me, or maybe even just share it with a friend. And if you have anybody that you'd like me to talk to that just isn't on enough podcasts, you know, any researchers, founders, investors, or just anybody doing cool stuff, hit me up and let me know. And I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.